Welcome to Close Play. I'm Tevis Thompson, and in this episode I'll be talking with Patrick Klepek about Dark Souls 3. Patrick is a senior reporter at Kotaku, and his articles often dig deep into the drama and dysfunction of video game culture. Dark Souls 3 is the latest sequel in what has become one of the defining series of modern gaming. The Souls games are known for their difficulty, but they're loved just as much for their intricate worlds, weighty combat, and pervasive sense of majesty and ruin. They've inspired countless players to question what both they and games themselves are capable of. In our conversation, Patrick and I talked at length about why those early Souls games meant so much to us, what the series has lost in becoming a dependable franchise, why game sequels are not only tolerated but celebrated by critics, and why expectations remain so very low in video game culture. Well, welcome, Patrick. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
I guess I'd like to just start talking about, I know we both have a history with the Souls games, and I think one time I heard you say that you felt that whatever Souls game you played first was the one you loved best, right?
Yeah, I think that's sort of a predominant theory that I've noticed with myself and also reading other people's experiences with the series. Is there's sort of a, you know, I think when you, for a long time, I looked at the series as sort of an outsider. I looked at it as a weird masochistic franchise that was only enjoyed by weird people that haven't given up on the way game design has changed in the modern age. Or just like, it's a hard game just to be hard. You know, it wasn't until Dark Souls 2 was coming out that I was like, well, I'm going to give, you know, I had the same approach to Spelunky, and then I played a bunch of hours of Spelunky, it went from a game that I thought was like that to, I think, probably one of the best games ever made, certainly
yep,
in
<I agree.
laughs> my top five very high up there. So I try to treat Dark Souls the exact same way. My wife was out of town for some conference for like a week and a half, and I was like, if I ever had a time to just figure this out, it's going to be it. And so for me, it was Dark Souls 1. But I think for a lot of people, you know, maybe they got into Dark Souls 2 because that was the one where the series kind of like started hitting its apex in terms of like lots more people were playing it and it was becoming more and more popular. And I really do think the first one you play where the series clicks for you or doesn't click, and as the case may be for lots of people, that becomes very formative. And I feel like you end up chasing the high of what's special about that series when you play the other games. And you can get close, but it's never quite the same as your first experience in that sort of play style.
So Dark Souls was your first, and it was just before Dark Souls 2, so like a little more than 2 years ago?
Yeah. I started with Dark Souls and then jumped like almost immediately into Dark Souls 2. And then played Demon Souls just before Bloodborne came out, then played Bloodborne, and then obviously jumped into Dark Souls 3 more recently.
So if you can think back to like when it clicked for you, or when you moved from that impression of it just being for masochists and to something that you actually enjoyed, as much as you can remember, what was that first experience of Dark Souls like? Like what?
Well, I remember specifically there was a boss fight where it clicked, and it was when you fight the two gargoyles as you're on your journey to ring the first bell in Dark Souls. And there was something about it was the first boss battle that I really struggled with. I think that fight is meant to be sort of like one of the first sort of like brick walls you run into, in which the game is saying, you know, you might have been able to kind of futz your way through up to this point, but now you're going to actually have to really start thinking about the flow of the combat because you have to manage two bosses at once. And, you know, I banged my head against it for an hour, and then the time that I did, which, you know, despite the fact that I'd internalized a lot of the fight, I still, you know, barely got by the skin of my teeth. It was like the feeling of euphoria upon finishing that fight, in which it was a, you know, like a little bit of luck, a lot of skill, observation. You know, it's like all these factors that come together at once that give you that feeling of euphoria when you finish the fight and when you've managed to defeat the boss. That's where it's suddenly like, oh, I get it. Like, this is why people, when they talk about Dark Souls, are like, they can't go back to other combat systems. Like, other games just seem pedestrian in comparison after playing it. Because I was fairly annoyed with the Dark Souls fan base as well. Because if you, and this is definitely true to this day, even as someone that is a big fan of the series now, if you're critical of the series, people don't take kindly to that. Yep. And I think part of that comes from this, you know, Dark Souls is an intensely personal experience. Despite the fact that you encounter other players and can have interactions, like, and it's an incredibly lonely solo experience. And so I think it's very personal to people. I don't think that excuses how crappy the community can be sometimes. But I suddenly, it was really like a light switch. Like, it was suddenly just, oh, I get it. And once I got it, I've tried to get it as much as I can.
Right. Well, did it affect when the light switch went on and you said that, you know, other it was hard to go back in some ways to the ways that other games do stuff. Was it really? When I think back on my own experience, it was kind of transformative, and so I'm wondering if it really, how far that went for you. Did it really make? Was there a before and after for it, or was it a little not that extreme?
No, I would have said, like, there. I consider in terms of the kinds of games I appreciate, and in fact, some of the values I appreciate in games to be Spelunky and Dark Souls. I tie together pretty tightly because I played them fairly close to one another obsessively, and I think while they're obviously very different games in scope, ambition, and design, that there's a lot of very similar design philosophies between the two. And I, prior to that, I had more or less been a story-focused person that enjoyed worlds and environments in video games. And while I'd grown up, you know, with very mechanically focused games, like, you know, Mega Man 2 is one of my favorite games of all time. And I also really enjoyed systems-driven games. Deus Ex is, like, tied with Mega Man 2 in terms of sort of, like, games that sort of fundamentally shifted what I valued in games. And I really haven't had a moment like that till Dark Souls and Spelunky came along, where I became, it really was like a turning point where it changed the kind of games I wanted to play. It made me view the games that I did play differently. And it really was like a very aha moment for both what that series was and what was possible in those types of games. I guess I just, as I got older, I valued challenge less. And it was more that, I don't know, there was something about the way that challenge and frustration are channeled in games like Dark Souls and Spelunky that I found to be deeply, I was appreciative of it in a way that I don't know if I necessarily saw other games doing as well, or at least I just didn't have the perspective on it till I played both of those games.
I see. Did the you said you liked before also like kind of story stuff in games and world, did that appeal to you a great deal in Dark Souls?
Sort of, not really. I've never. I play the Souls games largely for the combat. I'm definitely appreciative of the world. I like the world building that it does, but I don't really spend much time reading the item descriptions and try to piece together what happened. And in fact, what I kind of love about the series is that it allows for two different, you know, sort of narrative interpretations. Which is that the one that I prefer is to kind of just experience the world and imagine what's going on. It very much allows you to fill in the blanks. And but if you want that other side of it, which is to be like incredibly obsessive with tiny details, it's like it has its cake and eats it too, in which it allows the player to just sort of passively go through this experience and wonder what happened and imagine and theorize. And if you're the type of person that wants to know what happened, it does allow you to do that. If you and the community, through sort of like crowdsourcing of all the available information, you can piece together a huge chunks of what's occurred in that world. And so I think it's kind of interesting, but it's never, it's never been the reason that I've ever played these games.
Well, you know, I've heard Miyazaki talk about, you know, some of the inspirations and stuff, and that as much as the fan base gets into the lore and stuff, that he seems to talk as much about, he kind of doesn't want to talk about that, and he instead really focuses on the players, you know, filling in the gaps, right? Like, he talks about his experience reading, you know, Western books, the fantasy, you know, literature that he couldn't always understand, and so it would just stoke his imagination, and so it seems to be kind of built in. I'm like you. I appreciate some of the lore, but I'm much more interested in the feeling of being there, right? The world it presents through the architecture and the layout. I've read some, you know, the item descriptions, but I don't. I'm really interested in like my path through that world. For me, the big Demon's Souls was my big way in. And in fact, as I was thinking about it recently, it's really the reason I'm a game critic. It's not really like an exaggeration because, you know, before I played Demon's Souls, right before Dark Souls came out, September of 2011. And I'd heard about it. I'd been abroad for a number of years and was kind of coming back and had got a PS3 and was just trying to kind of catch up. And I'd written a few things before then that were, you know, about like, they were a little critical, like about Sonic. I mean, Sonic's not hard to criticize, you know.
no, it's very easy.
Right. And, you know, and some other games that I enjoyed. But I think every person, longtime player, can point to those moments where, you know, you kind of had this paradigm shift, right? Something, you know, the first time you play like Mario 64 that, you know, it just kind of like can't believe what's possible or something like that. And I hadn't had that in a long time. And I think that when I played it, it was so good in such a, you know, different way that it really made other games not just worse, but it some of the kind of niggling little like problems I had, it brought them into focus such that, you know, a few months later when I played Skyward Sword, that, it, you know, I ended up writing about that, but it wasn't, without Demon's Souls, I wouldn't have written about it. I just would have been like, oh, another like lackluster Zelda. But one,
right.
But once I saw, oh, actually, you know, I mean, you're always as a player trying to feel out like, is it just me and my memories? And, you know, it's always, yeah, our memories are a big part of that. But when you play something that says, no, actually, there are games that do something, you know, really kind of profound, then it sets everything else into like a different relief. And I remember the first, you know, few hours I played in Demon's Souls, you know, Castle of Boletaria, and it was, you know, I walked away from it just kind of on fire. You know, my mind was just kind of, the spaces were so real and it's so coherent. You know, like I guess I'd gotten used to video game spaces that were just like arenas with like wallpaper. You know, they just looked mm-hmm. like a place, but you knew where the walls were. You knew it didn't connect. It was just a bunch of rooms and hallways and the, you know, the walls didn't really matter. I remember the first time I tried to use like a long weapon in a narrow hallway and it bounced off the wall. And I was like, oh, the wall's really there. You know, like it's, you know, it's a small thing, but it's like,
right.
It was really in a sense of, you know, being present somewhere. It really gave a different feel. And I was so, you know, you're so used to games where you're like in Assassin's Creed jumping around and going everywhere and you're acrobatic and just, and this game was so weighty and like grounded and you don't move that well, you know, you're stuck to the ground. You can't jump very easily. And there's all this, you know, grand architecture around you that, you know, if you had a grappling hook, you'd be all over, but you don't. And, so yeah, it was just a real kind of like, games can still surprise me even at my age.
Well, I think part of the reason that it was that the series has hit as hard as it has, and I think for the people that were, you know, got in as early as Demon's Souls, like yourself, I think a lot of people came along with Dark Souls, and especially with Dark Souls 2 and 3, mm-hmm. Is, you know, it's a little less true now. Games have changed significantly in the last 5 years or so, but at the time that Demon's Souls was released, you know, there was this huge trend toward these story-based games that didn't really challenge players much. There was a lot of hand-holding that, you know, was very much tied into an increased visual fidelity that was possible, and so that was kind of the playground that a lot of games were going in. And then also there was this, you know, desire for mass market acceptance, and because these games are so expensive, you know, there's this feeling that players have to see everything, they have to do everything. If they don't keep moving, you know, the game has messed up, or the design is incomplete. And what I think was so revelatory about Demon's Souls as a player and for a lot of other people was that it's sort of okay with the fact that you're not going to see everything or you might not like it. Mm-hmm. It respects you, and I don't feel like a lot of games respect the player necessarily to the degree that the Souls games do. It wants to involve you in the experience in a way that is not really the goal or is not accomplished by a lot of other games. Like I just
I
feel like the designer is there in the Souls games in a way that I don't necessarily feel that way in a lot of other things.
Right. And but the designer with all that presence, right? We feel like we're in a, you know, it's created by a big team, but there's a vision here, right? There is a coherence to the whole like experience. And yet I think a lot of times when we talk about like it doesn't coddle you, but then we think that's just about the difficulty. But to me, it's both very present and yet somehow indifferent to you, right? It's not
yes.
at every turn like, look here, you know, be powerful, be cool, be have fun. Like it's just it allows you to like it just kind of lets it be and doesn't always, you know, it's a crafted, very crafted game, and yet the feelings in it are, you know, I remember when I got to the end of Demon's Souls and the very last boss, you know, the king who's kind of succumbed and he's like a slug, right? Like I remember thinking, this is it. This is the last boss. This pitiful creature before me. I just feel like sad. You know, I just feel like this, a game that evokes sadness and like pity. And I remember thinking it was the weirdest, like kind of cocktail of like, you know, this, you know, chemicals bathing my brain. I was so tense at times, and yet the beauty of it. And I think a lot of people, you know, can point to that way that it's not just like, you know, horrific or hard, but beautiful, but you know, there's this sense of ruin and loss everywhere. And it creates a really particular feeling that, even I played Dark Souls 2 months later, after, you know, when it came out, and, it hadn't faded yet. I was really taken with that game and really, really loved the world. I mean, really in a way that, you know, Demon's Souls, each level is kind of a self-contained universe, but in Dark Souls, up until you can warp between bonfires, it really, I'd never seen a vertical integrated map like that. And one that, you know, in my mind, I was always trying to like piece it together, get vantage points, see what was connected to what. And it was really exciting in a way that, you know, like when I used to read old video game magazines and they would show a map and I would be so excited to see something that was only in my mind before, because, you know, in games, you're piecing together to different, you know, Zelda screens or whatever, but when you see it all laid out there before you, you kind of see it differently. And Dark Souls never does that, but you're constantly doing it yourself, but you know, because you're just trying to get a foothold on the world so you don't get murdered, and so you're looking for any way to understand where you're at. And it was really powerful.
I mean, I think that's why I think my favorite moments in all of the games are actually maybe like the first 10 hours. And that has nothing to do with, you know, saying there isn't like interesting design or bosses or environments or anything like that happens as what goes on. But you are so incredibly powerless at the beginnings of these games.
Right.
And you have no idea what's in front of you. You're like, there is so much that you have to do to get a foothold in those worlds that slips away as you garner more stats and you can grind for souls. Like you can, and you know, that's the curve of the game. Like the game, you know, has you under its boot for, you know, in the early, and then is totally okay with the fact that you're going to reverse that role as the game progresses. But I those are my favorite. When it's a brand new world, you have no idea what's in it. And you have very little way of pushing back. Those tend to be my favorite moments in all of the games is those opening hours where it's ruthless and it's mysterious and it's scary and in a way that other games spend many more millions of dollars trying to evoke and the Souls game seems to do that with a much more seemingly limited palette, but I think it's just a much more effective use.
It is. And, you know, it is, it's true that, you know, you could say just at the beginning of things, everything's mysterious. But the thing is, the game invites, I mean, it really, I don't know, crafts that mystery in a way that when I played the first Demon's Souls, when I finished it, I immediately start. I didn't do New Game Plus. I wasn't really interested in that. I wanted to try a new character because when you're first playing the Souls game, you don't even know how anything works. Like, I mean, just the most basic things of how the online system works. I didn't even know how to summon people until, like, you know, I played through all of Demon's Souls and Dark Souls without really understanding that. I got invaded some, but frankly, I wasn't, I didn't have my full humanity to be invaded that often because I was killed so often. So it was only not till Dark Souls 2 that I fully, I think, kind of fully understood it, or in a way that I would use it. But right. Until then, that mystery, it's built in a way that's not simply not knowing, like, you know, at the beginning of every game. It's baked in a way that even after I was playing my second round of Demon's Souls, I didn't feel like a master of it. I know you can become a total master of it and, you know, do it with, you know, soul level one and all that. But I never right. went there. That wasn't the way I wanted to play it. And that sense of mystery, I'm like you, like the beginnings of those games, the first half. And maybe Dark Souls is a good example of when it really opens up. I think a lot of people would agree that the trip from the beginning of Dark Souls to Honor Londo is the best part. That once yeah. you get to Honor Londo, you get the ability to warp, and then you have to do those final things. Those are not the highlights of the game.
But I think actually the series, while I understand, you know, as it's made various concessions to become slightly more accessible without trying to compromise the core design, you know, I think a lot of the interface issues were absolutely things they should have, you know, cleaned up and have made the series at least more penetrable by newcomers. But that actual design choice to not open up warping until the halfway point in the original Dark Souls. Mm-hmm. They abandoned that in all the subsequent games. And I can understand why they did that, because it's annoying to run around. But the reason, it's not so much that, I mean, partially the original Dark Souls has an incredible world design and it's very intricate and thoughtful. But a huge part of why that's so memorable is because it's ingrained in your head, because mm-hmm. you had to run back and forth between different areas all the time. And I've always been disappointed that they've abandoned that completely. I think there's a way to compromise between the two of those, which essentially Dark Souls 1 did, which is like, we're going to give you this organic area, and then at some point we're going to flip it so you can explore and experiment. But for a brief period, you're going to feel on edge and have to really explore the nooks and crannies of this world because you don't have any other way to do it. And I've always thought that was a really deliberate, interesting design choice.
Absolutely.
That they, I think, unnecessarily abandoned in favor of making the game more accessible in future games.
Yeah, and I think we can talk soon about that in Dark Souls 3, but you're right that it has been in Dark Souls 2 and in Bloodborne, they've really... I mean, you're right, it requires a really well-thought-out, intricate world to work, because if it's really spread out and you're just really just backtracking, that's a very different feel. You know, if you're having in Dark Souls 2 to run across that world, it's not designed in a way... it's designed around warping. And so... frankly, one of my most powerful memories in Dark Souls was my first trip down into Blighttown.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't understand, you know, wear and tear on weapons, and my favorite weapon broke.
Oh no.
And, you know, I couldn't get back to fix it. I had to switch weapons, and you know, when you're gotten really a feel for a weapon, then to go to switch to another weapon is just like, it was really throwing me off balance. But I felt so deep in the earth, right? I felt so far from Firelink. I felt like I could really feel the distance, and it was oppressive. But, you know, finding the wherewithal to get out of Blighttown, it was completely memorable to me. And I think that, you know, it's not just that there's warping, it's that when people say there's too many bonfires or something like that, what it means is that the experience has been chopped up. Because, you know, there was warping in Demon's Souls, mm-hmm. And yet it wasn't really warping. It was, you start the level, you beat the first boss, and there's a warp point, and you beat the final boss. You know, like, right. You actually had to go through the entire level, which was also, you know, looping back on itself. And it wasn't quite the distance between them was really a journey, right? It was really an ordeal, and not just a little... 15 minute, you know, of play, and then you can save again.
It was truly like, I mean, you were holding your breath in those moments.
Absolutely.
Where you were, you know, I mean, the bonfires, if you know what you're doing, you know, they're probably about, you know, 15 minutes apart, but that stretches to, you know, an hour when you're first cautiously exploring an area. And I can remember some of my favorite moments in any of the games. It was definitely much more concentrated in Dark Souls 1 and Demon's Souls, was that sense of panic when you mm-hmm. have no more Estus flasks, or in Demon's Souls you ran out of all that grass.
Right.
I was glad they got rid of that.
Yeah.
You know, Estus Black is one of the smartest, most interesting design choices. And it constantly blows my mind how simple but brilliant it is. Yeah, like, and then when you turn that corner and you see that bonfire, I mean, I would get up out of my seat and cheer sometimes because it was so.
Your souls became so heavy, right? Back if you're fearful of losing them, you look at that number and you feel the weight of them. And I remember when you would finally spin them, I would get this lightness. You know, when you first enter a level and you have no souls, you're just willing to be like wild and fancy free. Like you'll try things. You know, there's no loss. But when you get weighed down further and further, it changes the way you play, and you can just it's just an intense feeling that it's not preserved when. I mean, I didn't feel that fear of losing souls very often in the more recent games because I was better, but I also there was just more opportunities to, you know, spend them and
yeah there's definitely, I mean, you know, we can get into this as the sort of the sequelized nature of the games, like, I mean, there's just, you know, they multiplied the bonfires as the series went along, and I think there's definitely a through line with the more you've played of these games, you know, the more comfortable you become. So you're removing the tension sort of naturally. But I think that has also come sort of part and parcel with the series. It's never fully compromised its design, but it is certainly, I think, accommodated in a way that prevents the games from having the sort of tension that previous ones did, purely because, they're less willing to allow you to kind of like hang out on your own than they did in the past.
Yeah. I think that's definitely true. So we're getting into the more recent ones. So I read your review of Dark Souls 3, but I would like to just know kind of what was it like to play it?
I mean, I think it's you can certainly see the designer's touch in this one. I think Dark Souls 2. I don't think it's a bad game. I think it's a bad Dark Souls game. I think Dark Souls 3 is a wild improvement over that. But it's so interesting to play them as sequels because, we talked early up front about how you're sort of constantly chasing the feeling you got the first time, which I think becomes increasingly hard with each, specifically a Dark Souls sequel. I think I felt that less in Dark Souls 3, even though it's a very well designed, pretty well oiled machine at this point. It's definitely a little more, you can see the bricks that they're laying in a way that takes away a little bit of the tension and mystery, which they got back, I think, fairly significantly in a game like Bloodborne by merely changing the mechanics and changing the setting. I describe Dark Souls 3 as a very well designed Dark Souls game, which is both a compliment and somewhat disappointing. I don't know that there's any way for the series to avoid that. I think it's sort of a natural consequence of being, essentially, if you include Demon Souls in Dark Souls, like design-wise, canonically, it's the fourth game. And by the time the fourth game comes around, what you expect is it for it to be extremely well-tuned and slick. And that's exactly what Dark Souls 3 is. And there's no way for it to do what you actually want it to do, which is to recreate that feeling, because it's the fourth one. So it's like the Dark Souls games, specifically the Dark Souls line, have essentially become like, for me, what Call of Duty or Madden is to other people, which is I love the basic design of these games so much that I'm willing to just go through the motions because the motions themselves are so incredibly satisfying and I don't get them almost anywhere else. So even if I'm not getting the sort of holistic experience that I got from the previous games, I'm willing to let that slide a little bit because what I get out of the combat is just not something I get nowhere else. So I think it's an exceptionally well-designed game that is also inherently disappointing because it's the fourth one.
Well, it's interesting because I feel somewhat similarly in terms of like, I know what sequels are like. I've been around games a real long time. And you're right. You can't get some of the soul's qualities anywhere else. And yet, I don't even know that I'm looking for... I'm not looking to re-experience something that I experienced the first time. I mean, I feel like I could go back and play Dark Souls. It's actually been long enough now that I kind of... I'm curious to... I've forgotten enough that, you know, it
right.
would be interesting to play it again. I certainly think about replaying Demon Souls. But, yeah, I... the comparison to like a Madden game or like a Call of Duty, especially a Call of Duty game, just makes me gives me this like overwhelming like sadness, because Dark Souls, what it does well, no other game seems to do, and I don't doubt that like Miyazaki or anybody at From could go in any number of wild directions. And I don't know what, you know, what their contract was or whatever led to like the creation of Dark Souls 3 and stuff. And Miyazaki walked away from Dark Souls 2 to work on Bloodborne. So I don't really know about that, but I know as a player, that sense of seeing a series, it wasn't a series before, seeing a game that was so singular, right? So unique, become like every... kind of like every other game in some ways, is, I don't know. It's just really,
I think it's a waste of their talents is what I would say. Like, I think Dark Souls 3 is like you know, it's a well-made game, mm-hmm. but you know, would I trade Dark Souls 3 for something brand new from what is clearly an incredibly mm-hmm. talented team mm-hmm. and a visionary designer? Like, I'd rather get that than a refinement of Souls. Like, I think Souls was essentially already refined with Dark Souls. Like, all that actually needed to exist was Demon Souls and Dark Souls.
Right.
And Dark Souls essentially sort of crystallized a lot of the formative ideas in Demon Souls. And I think took them to a very logical conclusion that Dark Souls 2 and 3 only exist for financial reasons. Right. You know, it's why they're, you know, they make various refinements, but I don't think any of the leaps between 2 and 3, any of the changes made, were necessary, right? And so I do think it is sort of a waste of their time, even if it's financially the right decision. And so, you know, in like the grander scheme, I wonder if, you know, by having gone through this, by having created these games, like maybe they put themselves in a position where they can do the things that I'd rather see that team and that designer do, which is to take the same daring leaps that Demon's Souls started. I mean, Demon's Souls is zigged while everyone else was zagging, and that's why right. it was important. Like, Demon's Souls is both a great game and was also benefited from when it was, you know, the time and place in which it was
sure.
released, because it's
sure.
contrary to a lot of existing game design that was popularized and becoming enshrined. And I would, you know, that in the time since Demon's Souls, a lot of games have then plucked from what, you know, the groundwork laid by Demon's Souls and Dark Souls, you know, not necessarily always as successfully, but it's been hugely influential. And now that they've done that, they've essentially become part of the establishment that they were sort of like raging against
right.
through that original game's design. And I'd rather see them focus those efforts elsewhere. So like, even though I can appreciate and enjoy Dark Souls 3 for what it is, that doesn't necessarily make me think, you know, that they shouldn't be focusing their efforts elsewhere.
Right, right. Well, you know, I mean, it's very typical for an upstart or a more experimental, innovative person or artist or team to become successful and become part of that establishment. I see that, and it feels like a waste of their talents and waste of their time. I guess I feel like it's a waste of our time too. And I when I first played it, like I said, I've played Dark Souls 2, I've played Bloodborne, which I enjoyed, but also felt Bloodborne was still too similar to Souls games to me, even though I liked a lot of aspects of it. So I didn't come into this with really unrealistic expectations. And I was trying to separate out when I was playing, you know, both my own history, because it, you know, I'm not playing this, you know, in a vacuum. I'm playing it in light of, you know, years of Souls games and their important role for me, but also just trying to look at what it's doing differently, actually noticing, you know, the bonfires, what that does in you know, taking a long kind of holistic experience and chopping it up into pieces, you know. And I see that when I play other games. I was playing Hyper Light Drifter recently, and its challenge, you know, if you lose, which you often will, it'll just set you back a little bit, but it the effect of that is to chop it up into all these little digestible pieces that are individually hard, but the shape of the journey isn't that hard. And that sometimes that longing for like a journey or an adventure that has its own, you know, shape is really strong in me. But you know, besides these things that are, you know, this game is more linear. It lays it out for you. It's not as, you know, don't feel the risk. You don't feel the weight. It's very balanced in ways that I felt like I could make mistakes. When I played Demon's Souls, I chose the Wanderer class, which I don't think exists anymore, but it was not a good choice for a first player, like a first time player. It was a mistake, and yet it was my first time. I didn't know what I was doing, and I had to adapt, you know, and it was hard. I made it unnecessarily hard for myself by accident. Whereas I feel like the game in its, you know, Dark Souls 3 really wants to be more accommodating and convenient, and it feels much more balanced. So I'm feeling out all those things, and yet over the last, I guess, month since playing it, it sets even worse with me. You know, there's sometimes you play a game, you have an opinion, and then it sets over time, and you know, you realize how it was actually a greater game than you realized, or worse. And this one continues to kind of like sour with me over time, because that feeling of waste, or the feeling of like looking around and being like, why is the community? And I don't just mean the hardcore or like a Souls community, but the game community kind of celebrating this. It doesn't feel to me like worth celebrating. I mean, you don't have to be as sad as me, or you don't have to like, you know, you don't have to like, it didn't play the same role. I mean, Demon's Soul really played an important role in not just being me as a critic, but being as like a writer. Like I wouldn't have, you know, made my graphic novel Second Quest if I hadn't played Demon's Souls, you know? So, you know, everybody has their own like, you know, connections or not, but the way that this is treated kind of like a victory lap, like something like a fulfillment, as if Dark Souls needed any refinement. You know, it was fine. It didn't need better combat. It didn't need any of those things. Or even the way that, you know, it's such a remix. I mean, this game, it's not just a sequel and has all the sequel issues. It is such like a blatant remix of the other ones. You can like point to all four previous games and find elements that are like directly there and just see the way that they're all brought together. And especially in the case of An Orlando. And I saw you had written about that, right? About the first time you had kind of seen it. You seem to really, you know, like that, right?
Well, I think I would separate my reaction to it in two different ways. I don't know if I necessarily thought it was really impressive in the context of the game and its lore and how they set up the reveal. It was more to have the feeling of coming full circle on a series. There was something about seeing that area which felt like, you know, such an accomplishment when I played that original game, beating that area, you know, beating ONS, like having, you know, even though there was more to Dark Souls after ONS and An Orlando, like that last third of the game, I think people forget is like pretty bad and not very good. I mean, the genius of Dark Souls is pretty much, you know, depending on how you feel with An Orlando, you know, up until that point, which I think we touched on before, but it was more like there was a certain catharsis and like experience, like seeing that area again and having a similar, you know, maybe not as extreme as the reaction that you had to the game, but a very much like, oh, like I've sort of mastered this game now. Like I haven't, you know, quote unquote mastered it in the way that, you know, people play these games, you know, with ridiculous setups and, right, and things like that. But like, I don't need to play another Dark Souls game. Like I just don't. Like I will, because as humans and creatures of habit, you know, I get an endorphin rush from the Souls games that I just do not get anywhere else. So there's an addictive quality, like a literally addictive quality to the Souls games that make me feel good, because I don't get that feeling from other games, which is both sad for other games and I think sad that I have to keep coming back to the Souls games for that feeling. You know, I think I described in my review that it felt like the Souls games have become sort of like what it's like with a sparring partner, where, I've spent several games learning what this partner does, but now I sort of understand what that partner is going to do, and then I'm pleasantly surprised when they surprise me. But that's not a high compliment.
Right. Well, that I remember when I recognized Anor Londo and saw it, there was, you know, that initial like, ooh, what are they gonna do with this? Right? Okay, so it's Anor Londo. Like what's gonna be, why is it here? You know, like I didn't know at first. I was kind of surprised like you were, and hadn't really seen it ahead of time. I was getting hints of that, but I was kind of thinking, how is this city connected to Anor Londo, or, you know, just visually, but not actually being there. And so once I got there, and I felt that initial kind of like, wow. And then immediately kind of like, wait, what? You know, like, what? Why is this here? Because, I mean, one of the things I love most about the Demon Souls and Dark Souls is really the internal consistency, right? I mean, Dark Souls, it is that Lordran is a place, this place from top to bottom. And my first question was, like, how did Anor Londo get down here? It was like a very simple geographic question. I was like, you know, how did this get here? And I remembered that, you know, in some ways, this Dark Souls 3 sets itself out as like this meeting place where different lands have converged, and it's all like very convenient for pulling in different locales without having to connect them too strongly. But I love the way that they're connected at the level of the world in Dark Souls and at the level of the level in Demon Souls. So there's something really coherent here, whereas this one, the coherence was like outside the game. It was across games, right? It was asking me to take a step back and like think about my entire Dark Souls experience and, like, you know, make the connections there, which for me are not, you know, the suspension of disbelief is broken then when you're asking me to like remember that I'm a fan or something and like, you know, do some fan thing. But as I explored it, I would, you know, people would leave, like, there were tons of notes there, you know, the blacksmith who's dead, they, you know, all these notes around him, like mourning him, and lots of notes with like Ornstein and Smog, like in that room once you defeat Aldrich. So there was a sense of community there. It was interesting, but I kept waiting. I was like, okay, well, maybe later in the game I'll find out why it was here. Or I'll find out.
Yeah, I mean, it's
what's the point?
The series never panders, which is, I think, an important, that's kind of critical to its design, and it's critical to its aesthetic. Like, you know, it's these games seem to, you know, or at least in the case of like Demons and Dark Souls, like exist as sort of like individual tomes. And I think the series has really struggled with being sequels because they increasingly feel like they have less to say. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like Demons and Dark, both, you know, even if you strip away the narrative, like they feel like statements. And the sequels, by their the statement was already said, and so there's just nothing left to say, which is why you end up being left with, you know, this sort of core combat that is still satisfying but also less satisifying, because as you know, you play through Dark Souls 3, like there's only a handful of bosses that do something interesting or inventive. Mostly it's just a variation on something you've seen before, because you're in this world for the fourth time, and there's only so much even a talented team like From Software can do Gothic fantasy for the fourth time, and within a limited set of mechanics that they couldn't ultimately change very much because you'd anger the base. And so I don't know, I just that's what I think you see straining at the edges in Dark Souls 3, and as I think sort of like a fundamental misstep at a conceptual level, is just they don't feel like, they feel perfunctory. They don't feel like they exist for a reason other than you made a sequel. Right. And so I think you can sort of, you know, you can understand the reasons why that happens and also be disappointed at the fact that they don't necessarily take away from Demons and Dark Souls in the way that...
No.
But they, I think you can say that it does sort of, it takes away in a sense that the fact that they exist in some ways, like, hurts some of the mystery of those previous games, hurts the ability for them to kind of stand on their own as like weird little artifacts. And so it's like, it's a game, like both Dark Souls 2 and 3, I feel better about 3 just because I think it's a, you know, it's a better designed game than 2, but they, Demons in Dark left such profound marks on like my soul after having played them. Whereas I don't feel that way with Dark Souls 2 and 3. Like, I enjoyed them in the moment, And then the further you get away from them, the more they felt like just perfunctory experiences that I enjoyed at the time, but don't necessarily think back on and go, wow, which right. is definitely not how I felt about Demons and right. Dark, in which, you know, as we both said, like, we're sort of important experiences.
Right. And, you know, this my experience with Demon Souls and Dark Souls are not really affected. Those are my experiences. But I fully expect with time the other Souls games to fade. I expect Demon Souls too. Demon Souls is just, I recognize that Dark Souls was the moment. I recognize that even though Demon Souls was my moment.
Right.
And that, you know, in the history of gaming, Dark Souls is going to have the chapter and Demon Souls will be like the you know, lesser played, like, you know, necessary game that came before. But that's fine. But I think that sense of what was so powerful about them has no play with the sequel, right? The singularity, the wholeness, and like the oneness of it's not open to iteration without a really profound loss. And so that pandering that you feel now was so against the kind of DNA of the early ones. I mean, I called, you know, online, I called it fan service, and then I got some objections to that, as if like the Souls games have always been about fan service. And I'm like, no, they haven't. Like, in jokes and things for the hardcore community, that's not fan service. Like,
right.
Dark Souls 3 Honor Orlando is fan service. It is pure fan service. And you know, we can talk about what fan service is and how to feel about that, but I don't think that Dark Souls and Demon Souls, you know, the fan service doesn't exist in an item description, or it doesn't exist in a little like in joke. Those are tiny, and they may be everywhere, but they are the whole of the game. It's not suffused with that sort of fan service or trying to please. And I think that was what had changed so much, is this sense that what was once indifferent has now turned towards the player. I feel the game looking at me in a different way, you know?
Yeah, like, no, I think that's a really good point.
Right? It used to be indifferent, and now, like all sequels go from like a first thing, and they pivot to the player. They are ready to serve. They are eager to please. It's a world made for you, the fan, right? The faithful player. Like, there's something that it's a fundamentally different mode. It's a comparative mode always. Sequels are always in light of their predecessors, and they kind of, they can try to really diverge, or they can really play that up. And I'll have to say that I agree with you that Dark Souls 3 in many ways is a better game than Dark Souls 2. But I dislike it more than Dark Souls 2, because Dark Souls 2 has many failures. And yet it's a little got more of its own identity than Dark Souls 3. Dark Souls 3, you know, Dark Souls 2 is not really a greatest hits game. And it makes a lot of mistakes, and it's not as inspired as a world. It's not as well made. And yet, I don't know that Dark Souls 2 panders as much as Dark Souls 3. I don't know that it, you know, kind of is looking at me quite so intently as Dark Souls 3 is. Dark Souls 3 is like, you know, like a sweet dog sometimes. It's like panting in front of me, and it wants me to like pet it. You know, I'm just like, I'm like, come on. Like, I... So, you know, it's, and admittedly, Dark Souls 3 comes after Dark Souls 2. So, you know, there's an exhaustion that builds up over time, that here we are, 2016, we've had Bloodborne, we've had Dark Souls 2, we've had Demons in Dark. Like, it just wears on me over time, such that Dark Souls 3 comes, despite its strengths, feels much worse. And definitely once I'm past it, because like you, in the moment, it has its moments, right? It has its... it's a little easier, I think, and I couldn't tell while I was playing if the game is actually easier. You know, it makes all those concessions we've talked about with balance and bonfires. But I mean, like, the bosses, like, I was not hitting my head until I got to Pontiff Sullivan. that stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah, the game doesn't really put any, you know, sort of like brick wall bosses, you know, ones that like just sort of force you to... Like, if prior to that, you can kind of brute force your way through the game, especially if you've played these games before, you kind of understand the rhythm of rolling and dodging, and you can just sort of get past a lot of the initial humps, and it feels like the second half of that game is where the, you know, they finally pivot to, oh, if you've played this game before, like, now we're going to throw some genuine surprise. And I think Pontiff is like maybe the best fight in the game, because it has what I find to be such an enjoyable arc for, you know, specifically of the combat, in which the best fights in the Souls games are when you walk in, you immediately get one-shotted. And you go, this is impossible. Like, what do you know? Like, why am I subjecting myself to this? Like, this is not fun. B, there's no way to do this. And then by the time usually the arc is that, you know, by the time you finished it, it's actually become fairly easy to finish that fight. And I think Pontiff is like a great example of, you walk in and you're like, this is, no, there's no pattern here. There's I don't understand what the heck is going on. And whereas when I ended up at the end of that fight, where I wasn't getting hit once because I had figured out how he was using his two swords, and like there was a lot of visual, like it was just all the stuff that like gets me going on those games.
Right.
And yeah, so you get to the end of that, and you know, again, like, you know, becomes sort of perfunctory, because you're sort of I want to waltz in and then get through that first phase. And then the second phase, I never quite figured out. I was just like, I don't know, I'll just bash on your face and then we'll get to the end. But yeah, the game takes an extremely long time to kind of like rev up, which I think is also what's, you know, I think it's a curse of these games getting more popular. Is I think you see this, I think, most acutely in Dark Souls 3, is I think they end up, because they become player focused in the way that you have talked about, and because that player focus is the result of them becoming more popular, because they're sequels, because they're appealing to trying to explicitly appeal to a wider audience to collect more sales. Essentially, the first half of the game has to be less interesting, because these games have gotten more interested in you progressing in a way that the first two games did not care whether you progressed.
Right. Right.
And that, I think, that makes them inherently less interesting, because it takes away some of their power. You know, some of the power of the earlier games was this sense that the game, like you said, was indifferent to you, which is like, if you stop here, the game gives no fucks that you stop. Like, woo-hoo, see you later. Whereas the games have not quite gotten, you know, to the hand-holdy part, but they have pivoted in a direction that wants to be more appealing. In a way that I think it takes away from what they can accomplish. And maybe that is just, you know, something that has to be lost, you know, when they become more popular. I don't know if that's something they can recapture or even want to recapture, but I do know, as a fan, I feel like that's part of the reason the games have lost their power as they've gone on, because even though they are still challenging, they are still difficult, they have shifted the goalposts in a way that they didn't in the past. Mm.
Well, why do you think, so we both understand the financial incentives for sequels and the contracts and all of the stuff that goes on, you know, that could lead to the sequelization of the Souls game. But the game community has celebrated that, you know, like the Dark Souls 3 has been very well received. And I'm curious what you think of why, not why sequels are made, but why players enjoy them, why the games community celebrates them. Why, given that I don't think we're the only people who, you know, feel some of these ways about the Souls games, and that it left such a mark a few years ago, that is, you know, some of the same people celebrating it, that mark was left on them in 2011. Why players are so understanding of sequels, so enjoy them, and why the community is, you know, so accepting of them?
Well, I think it's because players don't know what they want. And once you've given them something they like, it makes sense for you to want to like that again. And I think that's, you know, that's the very nature of sequels. But, you know, part of the reason that the Souls games were so powerful early on was because it gave people something they didn't know they wanted. And they were surprising in their design, because it existed off center from what was there before. Even though you can look at the Souls design and see like so many pieces of it in, you know, much earlier forms of game design. Like, it's very much, you know, the things that I knocked it for because I was ignorant are still true, in that it was, you know, pulling a lot from early game design.
Sure.
In terms of the way it deals with challenge and punishment and pushing back on the player. But like, it makes sense from a player's perspective that you would think like, yeah, I liked that. I want more of that. Whereas if Farm Software delivered something completely different, it might upset people because they think they want the sequel. But what you actually want, well, you know, is to feel that way you felt with Demons and Dark Souls, which isn't inherent to the design of Demon and Dark Souls. It's inherent to this magical feeling of like something new and exciting and different. Like that's at the root of what makes Demon and Dark Souls special. It's not that, you know, I love the combat, but it's like, that's not it. Like what's it is like this much more intangible thing that you don't know what it is till you play it. So in the vacuum of that, you end up going to the easier thing, which is just more of the thing you liked.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that makes a certain sense to me, except that when you play it, that might explain to me why you would try it again, but not why you would then celebrate it. You know what I mean? Like if the players, especially like the, you know, the critical community that, you know, is certainly played their share of Souls games and others, when you're playing that, you're looking for that. But the response generally isn't, and it wasn't there. This response generally is, good Souls game, like victory lap, like, you know, not like it's this kind of almost like, what are you gonna do? Games are sequels. So if you want to enjoy games, you better enjoy sequels. you know what I mean? Like there's this sense in which to ask, not just for like the first time, because I'm not really as interested in novelty as much as I am bored by obvious repetition that goes nowhere. I don't want like a little something to, you know, fascinate me just for a few minutes. I'm looking for like a powerful, a deep experience. One that, you know, I didn't even know was possible until I played Demon's Souls. So, you know, I recognize that those happen rarely, and maybe it, for the, you know, a lot of players, you can't wait for a Minecraft to come along. You can't wait for a Spelunky. You know, you got to do something in the meantime. And I'm playing games in the meantime too. But you know, this spring we've had so many major sequels, not just Dark Souls 3, but Uncharted 4, Street Fighter 5. I mean, Doom is a sequel, though. A really different kind, but and you know, that's just the air we breathe in gaming, and so I guess I just find myself often at odds with the kind of basic attitude towards these sequels. Not that we're not all looking for powerful experiences, but when we're not getting them, what's the response? The response isn't rejection. The response is, oh well, you know, what are you gonna do? You know, and I don't know if it's just this like I'm so deeply unrealistic, you know, compared to like a lot of players or game critics who are kind of like, come on, like Uncharted might have problems, but for what the kind of game it is, for what it's trying to do, it's good. And I'm like, no, I actually don't. I want to judge what it's trying to do. I don't just want to like already say, well, how good is it for an Uncharted game? I want to say, how good is it as a game? that is not the norm, and that is that's something you know I get pushback on all the time. So I understand part of it, but I don't get the especially the game, like the game, like journalism or writing community. There seems like to me at times just a kind of surrender, like it's like, I got to write about this. I got to write something. Like, what am I? I raise the question, like, are we even allowed to be like sad about games? You know, like sometimes we get mad or sometimes, you know, whatever. But how often, depending on how games, you know, what the role they play in our lives, like how much do we as players or as writers and critics, like say, you know, this is really like disappointing. This is not good. I guess I'm just not, I don't see a lot of that.
I think it might just, you know, part of it just might just be we're trained to expect this, right? You know, I think there is a certain sort of prison aspect to like the way games have always been made, which is like if we've grown up with sequels, we've grown to expect sequels, and then we're pleasantly surprised when games decide to be something a little bit different. And so I think it's difficult to break out of that mindset. When, you know, it's the you know, the weird part about games is that they're sort of inherently prone to sequels just because a lot of design is iterative.
Sure, and, sure.
You know, it's different than other storytelling mechanisms. But I think this is like part of something that is just sort of ingrained in how we've grown up with video games, and we, and like the playing of video games is a repetitive act, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so
yeah,
like,
it is.
Like it makes, it's the idea that we would be then satisfied by, I mean, it's just, I'm with you. Like, I understand the criticism that you're making of like, okay, it's a well-designed Dark Souls game, which is the thing that I complimented Dark Souls 3 on being. And that also being upset, you know, or critical of the idea that, well, maybe that's not a great thing in the sort of like the broader scheme of things. And I don't know. I mean, I think that's a really challenging notion, because you're right that it runs contrary to how a lot of players feel, which is I got this and then I want more of that. And so then it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy on the nature of sequels. Because I'm not sure if, you know, it's experiments aren't necessarily rewarded. And I think, you know, this idea of a path of least resistance is not, you know, we celebrate it because we've come to expect it, even if it's not necessarily the most fulfilling thing for pushing video games in different directions.
Yeah, it makes me really wonder about, and I've criticized gaming for this before, of just why our expectations are so low, and why, whether our expectations for games, how it's related to our expectations for ourselves, for our lives, for as we get older. I feel like a lot of people my own age, once we got into like our 30s, you know, we made a lot of mistakes in our 20s and didn't know what we were doing. And then in your 30s, you start to get a sense of what you know more what you're doing, though in many ways you really don't, but you feel like it, you know, you feel more confident. And yet there's, I felt a lot of my peers' expectations in their 30s go way down, like go kind of like, oh man, like now I see what life's about and it's really scary, and it's really like, you know, death is more real, everything's more real, and and there's just this sense of like, man, like I don't, if I have too high of expectations, I'm just gonna get disappointed. And it's, you know, the truth is, if you have high expectations with games, you're bound to be disappointed. And it may be hard to deal with that. I don't know if it's really about games. I do think games have a special way of connecting in a, you know, kind of primal, like right to our spine, in a way that like the disappointment and the way we, you know, feel accomplishment when we do things or failure, I think it's really different than other media. And so I think it's maybe some of these things are just exacerbated. But, you know, when we look at film and other media, the sequel of narrative is different than iteration of games. But, you know, a lot of, when I look at genre films or genre books that kind of, you know, are doing the same things over and over again. Like, I know you really love like horror, right, as a genre. And, you know, these Souls games have a lot of horror in them, especially like Bloodborne and Demon Souls, I think, but Dark Souls too. And some of my frustrations when I got some of my favorite movies the past, you know, 5 or 10 years are horror films, like Let the Right One In, or It Follows, or The Descent, or, you know, things like that. But I, in general, as a genre, I can't stand most horror movies. and it's not just, and it's not simply a matter of, you know, most stuff made in any genre stinks. I mean, okay, fine. But I mean that the kind of, when you become a fan of something, when you get into something, the way that genre films often, they start to build up their tropes, they become very aware of them, and they play on them. So again, it's a comparative mode of like, well, we're going to upend your expectations because we know what you expect, right? So it's this constant dialogue, which is interesting at times. But when I'm looking for a really powerful movie to kind of, you know, catch me off guard, you know, sequels in almost any, in any medium are not going to do that.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's this problem of, you know, Souls didn't have conventions and now it has conventions, right? And so it's like the existence of a fandom, the existence of a sequel, like there's not, like there's very little they can do. Like there, you have, once you've established, like the reason it was surprising the first time was this freshness, this lack of convention, but then the existence of it creates it as a convention. And so the sequel, like by its very nature, there's only so much it can do. And so like, it's, that's why the sequel in some ways is you know, a failure from the start, or is operating from a very weak position because they, you know, you have an expectation, thus the creation of those expectations can really harm the design if you're trying to chase the thing that was interesting the first time around. And it's you know, when I think about you know, the horror movies that I, you know, and I'm with you on If I Was and Let the Right One In and films like that, you know, being a fan of horror is similar to how I felt with like a Spelunky or a Dark Souls. Like the best kind of horror and the best kind of those kinds of games, like they make me feel alive in a way
sequels make you feel dead.
Well, I've had a very extreme interpretation of that, but like that like sort of intangible, you know, some of it's endorphin, some of it is an intangible feeling of like feeling alive and in the moment in a way that you're constantly looking for afterwards. And so I think we surrender ourselves to sequels because we're desperate to feel that again. And so we got it from that source. So maybe that source can do it again, but like there's almost no way for it to do that. Like that's like the very nature of going back to the same source, is that you're going back to it again, as opposed to if you remember why you got that hit in the first place, why that experience made you feel that way, why that story or that game or whatever made you feel that way, is because it was new. And so I think by their very nature, they're fundamentally flawed in providing the thing that we're looking for as humans, which is that familiar feel, that nostalgia, that high in whatever form it comes. We looked for it into a sequel because, you know, it's easier to go to the familiar place than it is to go to the unfamiliar one.
Sure.
Because that's scary. You don't know if it's going to give it to you. And
it probably won't. You know, most of the time it probably won't. You know, like it's easy to say experiment, do all these things, but experiments fail, right? You know, like you have to be willing to see some really bad shit or play some really bad games before you find something that, you know, really surprises you.
Right, and as you get older, as you know,
you have less time.
You have less time. Like you know, things like death do creep into your psyche. Like it becomes easier to, well, why go seeking the brand new thing when I can get like a slightly less intense version of it by going back to the thing that I got before? And I think that's the appealing, sort of as a base nature as humans, what is appealing about sequels is because it is, you know, as your time fills up, as you get older, as you, you know, fears of death and other things come to fruition, like it's easier to go back to that comfortable feeling because you'll get some part of it. It may be just a small percentage of how you felt the first time, but that small percentage is reliable. Mm-hmm. And you know that small percentage is going to be there, whereas having to dig through the trash to find something brand new, that's stressful. That's stressful in a way.
It's work.
That
it's exhausting.
It's work.
Yeah. I'm curious if you feel, since you are, you know, through your writing at Kotaku and your podcast and stream, you're like much more, you know, frankly connected to a lot of the gaming community than I am. And I was thinking that, you know, when you guys write at Kotaku about a game, someone writes about it for a while, right? You follow it, one person to like a game, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we're sort of, we call it like embedding. So
right,
trying
right.
to, you know, the very nature of writing about games professionally is, you know, because it's a business. So you're, you know, you're often tied to the sort of like the release schedule. And what Kotaku's tried to do is look at, you know, things like YouTube and Twitch, which show, you know, people enjoying games well past the, quote unquote, date that you're supposed to enjoy these games before you move on to the next one. So yeah, we're all assigned to various different games. Not really assigned. It's kind of like, what games are you interested in that you would enjoy continuing to cover? And you know, for me, that's been the Souls games for the past year and a half or so.
Well, I'm that seems to really extend the conversation in a way that, you know, certainly the games media, like, you know, is exhausting in its turnaround time for games. And I agree that people continue to play them and really off of those release windows. I know I do. I don't tend to play just only when it's hot. But it also made me wonder, like, if you get a game that disappoints you or that you don't like, is it hard to write about something at length that you might have problems with? You know, like, is there something in extending the coverage of the game and talking about it at a greater length, and engaging, like, the, you know, the gaming community in that way? Is it how easy is it to do that and really criticize something?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably something to that. I find that, you know, it's difficult for what my position, you know, to, you know, continue covering the games like Souls or any game that I'm sort of like assigned to covering at length, is that, like, the very nature of my job prevents me from playing games the way I would like to play them. I don't get to experience games the way that a normal person does, or I don't get to experience them in the way that even I would want to, mm-hmm. because I have to both keep up with things and investigate things and play games in certain ways that are tied to what I write and report about, which is inexorably tied to the business of running a website. And those things are not necessarily compatible with, or fully compatible with, the way that is the most enjoyable way to play things. So I find that to be a contradictory annoyance of my job is as cool. You know, I have a very cool job. Certainly I keep that in mind, and it's definitely true. But yeah, I'm very separated from the way, like, the average person plays, and, mm-hmm. and I find that to be frustrating, mm-hmm. because it influences the way you play that game. But in terms of being, like, critical of communities and stuff like that, like, that stuff's tough. Like, I can't think of an instance in which I have shied away from being critical of, like, the Dark Souls community because I'm, you know, would be quote unquote afraid of any sort of backlash. But it's certainly true that by being embedded in a community, you probably you gain a different perspective than you might if you were separated.
Sure,
from it.
Sure. Yeah, cause I sense that all the time, in the way that I'm in some ways more. I'm not sure how typical of a gamer I am compared to others, but I'm not really a part of that. And some of the ways that I play, the number of games I buy a year is relatively small. You know, I rent a lot of games, and mm-hmm. I play them in a maybe a different way or not. But I also I look at somewhere like Kotaku, and you guys are really good at, like, holding companies accountable, right? And, like, mm-hmm. You know, your news stories, like, you'll dig and you'll push the gaming community when it's, you know, being bullshit about any number of things. And yet, there's hardly any criticisms of the games themselves. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. not just Kotaku, but many places. And I've often been surprised that when I talk to individual people at places, our feelings aren't so far apart. And yet the ability to bring that into the conversation in an actual, you know, big game site, I don't know how much of it's part of it, the difficulty of the job, how much of it becomes like a kind of, maybe self-censorship is too strong a word, but when a line of thought is not easily pursuable, you think it less, you know what I mean? Like it when something, when it's not, then there's not an obvious way to, criticize the very nature of sequels, or, you know, some of the ways that those play out in individual games. Mm-hmm. You stop doing that, and I don't know how much of that is the factor, or it's just the basic question of why is there so little criticism of actual games. And I, you know, I know that they're tough reviews, but there's not that many still. And it's something that I continue to think about. You know, what's the source of that, or what? Where is it? Given that individuals seem to know the problems, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a lot of competing factors. I think, you know, one of the most pressing is the business of you know, writing about games, the business of getting criticism, of running websites that employ, you know, staffs of employees and things like that. It makes it very difficult to do that stuff because it's hard and takes a long time. You know, like to write a good piece of criticism is no easy effort. And
no,
I think that run, you know, the I look at the pieces that you do, you know, it's very clear that you take a long time to write.
Way too long.
Consider. but you know what I mean? Like, to do that stuff is takes real time, dedication, and effort, and thought, and all of those things are contrary to running an effective business. You know what I mean? Like at the scale that a lot of these websites run at, including Kotaku, I think another element of that is a lot of people aren't very good game critics. Like, I think I'm fairly poor as a critic and am very strong as a reporter. I think part of that has to do because I don't stretch that muscle as much. I think part of that has to do with my natural talents as a writer and where I kind of fit in that ecosystem. Because I think a lot of the people that write are paid to write about games aren't necessarily fantastic game critics. They may be good at other things, but like the business of being like a serious game critic is maybe not even something they signed up for. So like when they write reviews, like the perspective they're coming at it is like different than what I think would benefit game culture as like a lot of serious game criticism. It may fill the gap in different ways. I think also a factor in all of this is especially if you are a writer for a big website that has a lot of followers, and the kinds of things you can write can spread far and wide. Like a lot of game culture is incredibly toxic. And if you're going to spend your day writing about something, punches are pulled because do you want to spend the rest of your day getting shit on by the nastier elements of gaming culture? Like it's, that part's not fun. I think it's probably rare. And this is my experience having done this for 10 years, working with a lot of different people. I don't think people actively say, I don't want to write things that are critical or negative about games or communities. But I think there is a subconscious bias that exists as a result of extremely toxic elements of gaming culture that has people pulling punches because we have trained ourselves to not take the punches because it doesn't often seem worth it on a, like it may be worth it in this like holistic grand scheme of like changing the conversation about games and thinking about them on levels and perspectives that we don't normally do. But like on that day, on that week, when you have to deal with the fallout from that, I think that gets ingrained in a certain way that is really unfortunate, because I think that lack of a critical loop is bad for video games. It is bad for game fans. It is bad for game design. Like it is bad in all sorts of ways that don't benefit. They would make better games if that loop existed. But I think there are a lot of reasons it doesn't, and it bums me out. Unfortunately, that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, and it seems to reinforce like the community or the readership then becomes so used to writing that, you know, comforts them in their notions or celebrates, you know, kind of just that the idea that a gaming site or review should challenge the reader is just, it's not desired. It's not even valued. And besides not even having good and, you know, getting better games out of it, I feel like some of the conversations that happen, there seems like a great flattening effect. Like I don't feel like the full range of conversations and feelings about games and experiences, it's all flattened to this, you know, narrow, comforting, celebratory mode that does no justice, frankly, to like actual game experiences that we've all, you know, had. And yeah, that disappoints me. Even criticism aside, the kind of way that I do know how hard it is to, even with my much, you know, tinier reach, when I say something that I know is going to be not other people's experience, not what's being said, you know, my heart pounds. I feel that. And let alone if I were in a bigger environment or with a readership that, you know, really would come at me in a different way. I went to I had an interview last year for Second Quest at IGN. Mm-hmm. And I went there. I'd never been in an office like that. And I went up in the elevator, and the guy, Jose, who had kind of brought me in, was really super nice. And we had a really nice conversation. But I remember when I was walking through the offices, looking around, and there was like, I came out of the door and there was like a Dark Souls statue. And then beside it was like a Skyrim statue. And there were two Lara Crofts. And like, I was looking around at this environment and thinking, it would be really hard to write what I write here. You know, just like the very attitude of like trying to, I don't know, like the atmosphere here is, I was just looking around and being like, damn, like,
It's true. Like there, I feel like, there's a danger when you work, for gaming websites that in some ways you have to sort of like cheerlead the industry. And I feel like that's like, there's this very, that, and I think a lot of that is an unconscious bias as opposed to something that you know, writers that, you know, whether it's a publication like IGN or anywhere else, are out like specifically saying like, we're only gonna say good things about video games. But I think like it's very, it's like a very natural extension or place to end up in by being surrounded by that all the time. And I think there's also a problem in a lot of people that sort of like self-identify with games or like that's like their main medium. I think there's a tendency amongst people like that to only indulge in that medium. And games tell very specific, a limited range of stories and designs. Like there's not as wide of a breadth as you would like. And if I think a lot of people do themselves a disservice and have trouble criticizing games because I'm not sure they even know what to criticize, right? Like if you're if you're trapped in, if your primary means of experiencing media is video games, like you don't, you're not even gonna have the context or the vocabulary to criticize them, because if that's all you know, like that's why the range of criticism is probably, I think, one reason why the range of criticism in games is so limited, because I don't even think a lot of people have a sense of what you would even be criticizing.
No, I think that's true. I think when I look at the recent, like, you know, crazy high reviews for Uncharted, and I just finished it recently and really didn't like it. And I,
yeah, hey, at least you know what? Usually, you know, we're on different sides of the fence on things, but I'm with you on that one. I don't,
you don't like it. Are you, have you finished it?
Yeah, I finished Uncharted 4. This is part, you know, when people say Dark Souls ruins other games for you, like it makes it like incredibly clear when you play games with like complete garbage mechanics, like the Uncharted games. Like I can't stand to shoot things game, and you do it a lot in that game. Uh-huh. Like I'd much rather watch an interactive movie like written by like the Naughty Dog studio. Like I think that part they do very well, but I can't stand to play Uncharted, which is probably a problem.
I recognize that, like, it, about by like the halfway point, I was like, every time I knew the gameplay section was coming, I was just like, oh please just get me out of this. Like,
I know
the encounters were so just boring. They were like, how many times have I snuck around and strangled a dude in my gaming life? You know, like I can't, you know, like how many times can you shoot a person from cover? Like just how many times can you do that? Because I just don't understand. How many times can you climb and scale a cliff? Like, you know, after the 100th time that a ledge breaks and you fall, like it's like a joke. And as I'm playing it and I'm just reading the reviews and being like, what are we on different planets here? Because like, I don't believe that everyone is loving the fighting, the shooting, but they accept it. They accept it in some way that I am just like, every time I'm doing it, I'm like, no. And just on like a, when people talk about the story, how like, you know, maturity, I mean, granted, I enjoyed most of The Last of Us, especially the Left Behind DLC, but
yeah, me too.
They have some very talented writers there, but man, there were times every time I would die and, you know, like someone would call out my name, I would laugh. And every time, because it was just, there was a constant sense of ridiculousness where it would be trying to tell a more serious story and that the mechanics were the same. You know, they're refined. They're, you know, a little better than they were before.
Right.
But they can't, you can't say, near the end when you're like, you're going to get your brother, and it's like, you know, Brother's Keeper comes on the screen and it's like, okay, let's go get Sam. And then you have to climb for 15 minutes. And it's just like, it's just a joke to me. I'm just like, I don't understand anything that's any way this is supposed to come together. And even things like the Madagascar section and King City, when you're, you know, the part that was previewed at E3 last year, that whole mm-hmm. section, I wonder if people, I saw some criticisms that would talk about, you know, what it means for like a bunch of, you know, two guys in a car, two Westerners to like run rampant through the city. And they make a joke halfway through, like, you know, we can never come back here. And then I think Sully's like, add it to the list. And it's just like at the very end, you know, they're laughing about it. And I'm just like, I guess I just don't get how the scene where you've like to have your fun, can the game encourages this, you know, whatever. I can't stand games that have regrets, that act like, you know, they feel guilty about things that they clearly are wanting you to enjoy. But this, you know, trying to give this a deeper story, trying to give it more resonance, you know, in maturity, it totally can't work with these mechanics. You can't run through a city and destroy it for right. fun and have any kind of, I don't know, like feeling or guilt or anything about that. So at the end, like when they're going to, like, you know, maybe at the epilogue, they're going to have some big thing talking with, it's time to tell Cassie the truth. And I was like, oh, you're going to tell them that you're like killed a bunch of people? And like, is that the truth? Is that the truth?
You've essentially committed genocide over the last four games.
and it's weird because this is not like, these are not like new observations. Like, people have been observing the body counts in Uncharted for all of the games. But at least like in Uncharted 2, the tone, you know, its jocularity and all that, it may not work, but it worked a lot better than like a serious story that then makes it unsupportable what's happening. And just boring. And just flat, plain boring to do all those things. And I don't get why so many people know these problems and yet it's treated like it is.
Well, I think one thing that's endemic to, this is probably not only game criticism, but the way reviews tend to get assigned out tends to be people who are already like, interested in the object to begin with.
Right.
So like that's a limitation of my ability to even criticize Dark Souls 3 is like, I'm already, like, I like Dark Souls, right? So I'm like, I'm going to pepper over certain things by virtue of that familiarity where, like, you know, one of my favorite critics ever, you know, is Roger Ebert. And, like, what was amazing about Roger Ebert was that he reviewed everything, right? Mm-hmm, so, like, his lens was his lens, but his lens was applied to all sorts of different things as opposed to... I'm sure he reviewed movies that, you know, were predisposed to him liking, but what was amazing as a critic was being able to leverage that against like everything he reviewed, and that's not something you see a lot in.
There's no breadth, right? Most people have their niches, and games take so much time and so much, like, you know, learning even how to do different kinds of games. Like, there is a total lack of breadth within gaming across genres and then across mediums outside of gaming, and then just even the breadth of like being a human playing a game, you know, like there's just something essentially the way a fan or a, you know, a game critic or reviewer talks, they just don't sound human to me. Like, there's just something like they cut off part of themselves in order to talk this way. And I'm like full of all these other human feelings when I'm playing these things that I'm like, where is it?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's one of those things that I think you see, you know, a place like Critical Distance that, collect, you know, this much wider breadth of like there is more interesting criticism happening. It's just not a lot of it is presented in the places where it can have the most impact. I think there is a lot of interesting, you know, I like the fact that Critical Distance points you towards like lots of different people that are saying lots of interesting things. But, you know, when you cut to the core of it, like no one's reading it, you know, like it's being read by a lot of, you know, people who are really into critical discourse and trying to find disparate opinions and stuff like that. But, you know, that's not the thing that gets viewed, you know, 500,000 times and, you know, gets sent through, you know, an executive chain and maybe has an impact in a way that we would all like to see games before. And like, that's a criticism of both Kotaku and lots of other websites that don't put enough effort into finding ways to raise up those voices and put them in platforms that can change games in a meaningful way.
And to be honest, I feel like part of the problem with Critical Distance is that it's still far too academic, the kinds of pieces it links to and the kind of sensibilities that, you know, it's not just that they're being overlooked. It's that most people don't want to read academic discourse. And I understand why. I've been in academia a long time, but, you know, not now, but in my past. And, you know, the academic mindset and the way that the lenses, you know, they may be different than most game lenses, but there's a narrowness in academia that sets in very quickly. And that I still, you know, even when I'm reading pieces on Critical Distance, I'm like, this isn't that critical. Like, I mean, it's critical in like a academic sense. When you're being critical in academia, that is not about being, you know, critical, being harsh or whatever. It's about, you know, this way of thinking about it. But I'm just like, The celebratory mindset is still all over Critical Distance. You know, there is still, and part of that's maybe being on the internet where the stakes are difficult. But I don't think it's just that. I think there is the kind of things we're talking about in the broader, you know, wider game journalism community is the smaller critical, more academic groups are not immune to that. And I feel like, you read criticisms of Uncharted or you read criticisms of BioShock Infinite, you read those kind of things and they're still kind of like, they pull their punches. They do not say exactly what they think. And, you know, maybe this is part of the problem of writing online or just writing in general of how to say what you think and how you feel. And that feeling could be really messy. I mean, it's not comfortable to talk about sadness, you know? It's not great to, like, I feel vulnerable. I don't really want to talk about Dark Souls 3 making me sad and why that makes me dislike it so much. Because, you know, that's... But if I don't, then there's something like dishonest going on, and there's something like I'm not somehow not getting at the truth, or at least the truth for me. And it's I don't know. It ends up becoming uninteresting. You know, there's no lacking of smart people in gaming at any level, like in Critical Distance or in gaming websites or among players. There's like no lack of that. But it's the way that that intelligence is being used or not used. You know, it doesn't it doesn't seem to involve the whole, you know, thinking, feeling person. And I don't know if it's because of our expectations with games or because something about games brings out something in us sometimes that we don't want other people to see. I think it does sometimes. I think games provoke us and, you know, they kind of bring out parts of us that we're like feel not so proud of or something. But
right.
The Souls games... I feel like they are a little more open, at least in the early games, about what they're demanding of you and what they're drawing out of you. They seem, you know, those who love them, they lay you bare a little bit, right? They make you vulnerable and sometimes make you face yourself in ways that are rare in games. And
they're games that inspire conversation. Like when I played them for the first time, all I wanted to do was to talk to other people about them. And that's just incredibly, like so many games I play, even ones that I enjoyed, just vanish, from my consciousness the moment that, you know, the credits roll. And it's not to say I didn't, you know, it is that feeling of in the moment, oh, I enjoyed it and I respect what it did and it did it well. But there's something about those games. There's something about very few experiences you have that sort of like shake you to your core, and you just have to like, and it's why I understand why like early Souls fans were like screaming, like, why aren't more people playing these games?
Right,
because, and I think that leads to, you know, why that community can sometimes be a problem is this, you have this, like you had this experience and you want everyone else to have that experience. And the ways that get expressed sometimes is not always the most helpful, but I understand where that point of view comes from, because, you know, it sounds like we both had, you know, sort of formative experiences with these games, and then you want other people to feel that way because it made me feel so good. I want the other people to feel that as well.
Right. And it makes you, I don't know, if you're invested in gaming more broadly, not just finding the games that you will really love, then there's something when I played Demon's Souls, I was hopeful, you know? I was hopeful about games again in a way that I hadn't been in a while. It in a way that, you know, Minecraft makes me hopeful. Mario 64 made me hopeful. Super Mario Brothers made me hopeful. You know, there was something about them that suggested games could do something. Because, you know, even some of the games I really enjoy, they're often very breezy, right? They pass through you. They're a good time. They're good. They're fun. And yet they don't last, or they don't leave much of an impression. And when a game does, and you're like, wow, like, not just I want more of this, but obviously games can do this.
Well, yeah, and I think it's when, you know, people ask me, like, you know, why do you play video games? Like, there are lots of games I enjoy, but there are like precious few that I would point to as sort of like, this is a reason for video games to exist as a medium. And the Souls games, at least, you know, the early ones, like those make me feel better about the choices I've made with my time and what I dedicate, you know, sort of my career to, is like, oh, right. Like, I'm not going to get this every day. And things like this might come around fewer times than I would hope. Like, nothing else makes me feel this way.
Thanks a lot for talking to me, Patrick. It was a great conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this was a pleasure.